places, everyone. Quiet on the set. Curtains in five.
Hello, and welcome to Footlights, a community theater podcast coming to you from the studios of WVIK Radio on the beautiful campus of Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois. I'm Chris Hicks, and joining me today as co-host is my favorite director, Jake Ladd.
Hi, Chris. How are you? And thanks for having me back.
Oh, my pleasure. And our guest today is someone that I've known about forever, and she comes from a theater dynasty. Welcome, Dana Skiles from Richmond Hill Players in Geneseo, Illinois.
Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, I want to know all about you. All about you. Dana is second generation? Third generation. Oh, that's right. I saw that in the program. Mm-hmm. And you're fresh off of directing...
My Son Is Crazy, but Promising. It is a mouthful, but...
I was just talking to Jake out in the lobby, and it was like, I have so much trouble remembering names of plays that I've seen because I've seen so many this year. But and a really good result was you had a sellout on your last performance. Is that correct?
We actually had multiple sellouts for
awesome.
This show.
Awesome. So tell us how you got into theater.
Well, first started with dinner theater. Richmond Hill used to do dinner theater at a place called The Deck, which is unfortunately no longer in Geneseo. And because it was not our space, we had to build the set, stage and everything every single time. I was tiny, and I knew how to use a crescent wrench, so my dad would send me under there to undo all the bolts. That was my first foray into theater.
And so creative.
Oh, yes. But then I started working on crew because I was so interested in it. And then I started auditioning, started getting small parts, worked my way up backstage, up to stage managing, and eventually directing. I do my own lights and sound now. I've directed, this was my 10th show that I've directed out there.
Wow. I found that I was reading about you. We've never actually met, but I know of you. And there was an interesting quote in the paper, and I made a note of it because I wanted to ask you about it today. And that you likened directing on a certain level to being a parent.
A little bit, yeah.
You know, you remember the quote I'm talking about? And how you sort of become the parent to the cast and the company as a whole. And my background and training is as a director, and I related to that. And like you, I'm also not a parent, but it you do end up taking on that role, whether you like it or not. Talk about that a little bit, because it's a very unusual position that a director finds themselves in, and if you haven't directed, you don't know what that's like.
So. Yeah, directing, I've talked to my mom about it, and I'm like, do you ever want to direct? And she said, no, absolutely not. Because she sees how much goes into it. It's not just the blocking and, hey, show more emotion on this part. You have to be more of a leader, more of a good role model. You're leading by example. You've got all your ducks in a row. And there's so much more that goes into it. And you kind of take these people under your wing and take their characters under your wing and see them grow and develop. And I believe what you were quoting is when it gets to opening night, it's like sending them off to college. And you hope that you did everything right to prepare them for what's about to happen, because it's out of your hands at that point.
It's also interesting because along the way, you see in your cast and sometimes crew as well, the entire gamut of life experiences going on in their personal lives as well. A lot of that ends up in the rehearsal process as well. And a lot of it falls to the director to handle, to sometimes massage egos, to sort of settle interpersonal issues. Mm-hmm. It's a lot like a family. And as a director, as you just pointed out, the responsibility all falls to you.
Oh, yeah. And I've been very, very lucky. And I haven't had a show where I've had big discrepancies between people or anything like that. You know, little tiffs here and there, handle those just fine. I've been very lucky that the community of actors that we have come to Richmond Hill are, they don't have to be there. They want to be there. So everybody wants to make it a great experience. So that helps in not having, you know, disputes like you would have at work, where you're forced to work with this person that you don't care for. At the theater, everybody wants to be there. Everybody's going towards the same goal. Everybody wants it to be a great show. So that helps people to put those disagreements aside.
And everyone is looking to you to provide the vision for the show.
Yes. So. Seeing things from the whole big picture down to the minute details of what shoes people are wearing. You know, all these sorts of things. It's a lot, but it's a great thing when you see that opening night and you see the crowd smiling out there. It's like, it was all worth it every time.
I should have mentioned, I think, that Geneseo is about 20 miles outside of the metro Quad Cities.
Yes.
And you are the only venue within several miles that performs in the round. Talk about have you just ever acted in a proscenium situation, and discuss the differences between acting in the round and conventional?
I've been on several different stages. I've been on proscenium stages. I've been on what's called a galley stage, I think that's the term, where it has audience members on opposite sides, which is a very strange venue.
Where was that?
That was when I was down at college in Macomb.
Oh,
their community theater has that set up. It's very strange. But acting in the round it's a lot more immersive for the audience and for the actors, because you have audience on all four sides. There's nothing to hide. You can't turn away from the audience if you're starting to break character, you know, or you forget your line or something like that. Because every time you turn around, there's more people, which makes it a little bit more difficult to stage certain things as a director. Last year I did the show Misery, based on Stephen King. And that, I had to get a little creative with certain scenes.
You had to direct your mother in that.
Yes. And she was terrifying.
And we need to get into that family dynasty somewhere down the road here.
Yes. But being in the round, it's, like I said, it's a much more immersive experience. And it forces you to think outside the box, which I think is a great thing. Because most of the scripts that you get are written for a proscenium stage.
Right.
They have blocking in there. We have to change 90% of it because it just wouldn't work. There is no stage left.
It's a more immediate experience for the audience as well. I have found, and I don't know if you have found this as well. Well, let me ask you, Dana, the majority of the actors that come to audition for shows at Richmond Hill, have most of them worked there before?
I'd say it's about 50-50. We get a lot of new people from Playcrafters, Music Guild, people who've never acted before. And My Son is Crazy But Promising, the lead actor, Bud Granger, played by Derek Bolme, had never been on stage before. And I threw him into the deep end, and he did great.
Well, the reason I asked is because I have found that so many of the actors who have, you know, worked at most of the theaters right in the Quad Cities have never had the experience of working in the round. And it is exactly as you say. It is relearning a craft almost to perform that way.
Right. And because on a proscenium stage, you kind of default to facing the audience. You default to face in a certain direction when you're having a conversation or anything like that. There is no default in the round. If you're giving a speech that takes 2 minutes, you have to keep moving. Otherwise, half the audience could be looking at your backside the whole time. We don't want that.
Well, I find it impressive, too, that you have so many actors that come all the way from Davenport.
Davenport, Galesburg.
Because from Moline.
Oh, yeah.
Galesburg, yeah, Justin Raver. At one time was in Galesburg.
He's in Kewaunee now.
Kewaunee, that's yeah. right. Sorry. I should know that. He was my son's best man at his wedding.
Oh, gee.
But they, for me, from Moline, I allow a half hour to get out to Geneseo. And people coming from Davenport, that's quite a stretch to come and on a nightly basis for rehearsals. So that's pretty yeah. impressive.
It's usually we have rehearsals three nights a week. And
oh, really?
Yeah. That's it depends on the play. We've had some directors that do four nights a week, but standard practice at Richmond Hill is three nights a week for 6 weeks. So it's not too bad. And most directors will have Sunday night rehearsals. So it's Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday. So you get a break in between. But Sundays aren't bad for most people because they're not coming from work.
True. True. You can start a little earlier than you would right. on a weeknight.
And it depends on where you work, how much you speed. All of that determines whether or not it's a trek. But because I work in Davenport, I go to rehearsal straight afterwards, but then I live in Geneseo. So coming back to Geneseo anyway.
Now let's back up and go through your family dynasty.
Okay. So the start of it was my grandma, Laura Favor, was one of the founding members. I believe she was the first secretary at Richmond Hill.
On the board.
Yes.
Yeah.
If I may interject, this is what, the 56th season or 7th? 56th.
Yeah. Sorry, I had to count. And she was more on the background side of things. She did act a little bit, but in her later years, not so much. But she would help out and she would come and see every single show. And she absolutely loved the theater. And she's why my mom got involved. My mom started acting, and then she's done a lot of stage managing. She's by far one of the best stage managers that Richmond Hill has because she's so organized, partially because of her job. And then she kind of forced my dad to get into it.
I was just going to ask.
Kind of dragged him
along. She's the one who drew dad in.
And he started with helping with sets and stuff like that. And he's stage managed as well, another great stage manager. And then he's now gotten into directing. He's acted a lot. He actually prefers the smaller side characters because he gets to have fun but doesn't have to memorize 300 lines. And then my sister did a couple of shows when she was younger.
Oh, now that's interesting because yep. I've never seen your sister listed in anything. And I was going to ask you if you had siblings, just yep. a sister, or do you have any more?
I have a half-brother. He has no interest in being on the stage. He's petrified. But my sister did one show at Richmond Hill way back in the day, I think 2003. And then she did another show up at Playcrafters, and she wants to act more, but she works a third shift job, so she doesn't oh. have the scheduling ability for it. But my niece, we have dragged her into it, and she loves it. She loved that she didn't have any lines. That was her favorite part.
Was she the one at My Son Is Promising that went around?
Yeah.
Was that the show that with the umbrella?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. That was your niece?
That was my niece.
Oh!
Yeah, and that was the first show she'd ever been at Richmond Hill. It wasn't a part of the show. It's not written into the script. It was just something I thought about adding. I was like, "What? Who's a little tiny person that I can bring in?" My niece. She's tiny. She'll work. I can dress her up as an alien. And she loved it. She got a kick out of it. And she recently just auditioned for out in Orion, they're doing Wizard of Oz, and she auditioned for that, and she's going to be Munchkin, so she's caught the bug.
Oh my!
So very excited to bring her into the fold. Other family members that we have, my uncle has started helping with set building. He's been in several shows. He played Dimitri.
Right.
In the show.
I forget now because there's so many of you Skiles.
Yes, there are many.
Is he Mike, your uncle, or is Mike your dad?
Mike is my dad.
Okay.
Jim is my uncle.
Okay.
And so he started helping out with set building, and when I gave him the role of Dimitri, 3 months before we started rehearsals, he was already building all these little gadgets and stuff to use for his character. He loves tinkering and stuff like that. I think his favorite show to be a part of was 1940s Radio Hour.
Oh, yeah. He got to do the sound effects.
Because he was one of the Foley artists. Him and my dad were the Foley artists. And they just, no lines, but they got to play with all the toys and make all the noises. And they had a blast.
Hicks liked that show because for a while, he and I had a group of actors that went around to the senior living communities, mm-hmm. and we performed Golden Age of Radio scripts for the people at residents at these places. And he did the sound effects for the radio show, so we really enjoyed that show.
Yeah, that was a good one. So, and then his wife, my Aunt Marie, has also helped with costumes and stuff like that. She's the one who made his blown-up outfit in that show. She's helped with set painting and stuff like that. I don't think she ever wants to be on stage, though.
Now, I'm going to be remiss if I don't bring this up because Mr. Hicks will scold me.
Uh-oh.
Your performance space is in the round.
Yes.
But could be described in comparison with other theater venues as minuscule.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. We have a very small stage.
And he contends that if you just took one row out of each section, it would be so much easier to perform in.
Having more room on the sides isn't really the issue with the performance space. The problem is to go off stage or to come on stage, it is maybe a foot and a half to 2 foot of clearance. So if you have to leave very quickly, you have to be sure that you are aimed properly. So we could improve the space by that, but if we
Have you ever had any discussion about that?
I think it's because the stage that we have was made from the boards of the original barn. So it's a very historic stage. That stage, those boards don't go all the way.
Ooh.
So we would have to do that. Plus our lighting grid is designed for that size of space. I think it's like 16 feet by 18 feet. Something like that. It's designed for that space. So if we started removing rows, it changes a lot. A lot more than people think. We have had some shows like the 1940s show where we've removed an entire side of seats and built part of the stage onto that. And for that, we have to go up and move half of the lights on the light grid.
Well, I am so glad that I asked this question. Now I can go home, tell him that, and hopefully he'll stop whining about it.
But I think that if another thing is if we started removing rows and making the stage bigger, it would start to remove some of that intimacy that you feel when you go to see the show. Because the further away you are from the actors, not only is it harder to hear them, you can't see their facial expressions as easily and stuff like that, but you're further away from the other audience members, too. So it starts to feel like you're watching a movie rather than being a part of the story.
Mm, interesting.
So. Well, and one of the aspects of theater in the round, one of the things that makes it work so well is the intimacy and the immersive nature of it that you've mentioned, Dana. Mm-hmm. I find that having the actors within almost an arm's reach of the audience can be extremely compelling. theater.
Well, I've been to shows out there where the set was resting against my shins.
And it's I feel, in my experience, it's a completely different acting experience as well, because you can use these subtle facial movements and subtle hand movements and stuff to where if you were on a proscenium where the closest audience member is 50 feet away from you, they're not going to catch those subtle things. So especially for heavy dramas like we recently did of Mice and Men, doing those subtle facial movements and those little slightly moving your body and stuff like that, they work so much better when every audience member can see it because they're so close. Whereas when you're on a proscenium or a big stage like Music Guild, you have to be very broad with your movements in order for the audience to even catch that you're moving at all.
Very good. This is good. You brought things to my mind that I had not taken into consideration before.
Well, I seem to remember a conversation with a certain actress and company when we were doing a production at Playcrafters, which combines three-quarter round with classic proscenium. And the acting style for the cast has to shift constantly because it is what Dana's referring to is when you are working in three-quarter round or in theater in the round, the style of performance is more akin to film and television. It is so much more subtle because the audience is right there. Then you shift to working on the proscenium portion of the stage, and it's a completely different style of acting. And the reason Chris was socking me in the arm a moment ago when you were talking about your rehearsal schedule is because as a result of that particular element that you were discussing, they needed more rehearsal time because that cast had never had the experience of having to shift from proscenium work to in the round, back and forth. And that play is a very presentational style of play. So it required more rehearsal.
Oh, yeah, sure.
No. So they were rehearsing 4 or 5 nights a week as opposed to 3 nights a week, which is why Chris socked me in the arm when you said 3 nights a week.
Now, how many years have you been involved in theater?
Officially, I was
from the Crescent Wrench era.
The Crescent Wrench, going on 25 years now.
Wow.
Close to it.
How many plays have you been in? You said you've directed 10.
Yes.
So how many plays have you been in?
On stage? Oh, jeez. I'd have to go back through the history and write them all down. I'd say probably about 15, but I've been involved in probably another 30 backstage.
So two-pronged question.
Yes.
What was your favorite role? Do you have, and two, do you have a role that you would love to play? And you're still pretty young, your options are pretty wide.
I've got a range to go. favorite role? I would probably have to say it's one of my more recent ones. Last year, I was
She's
in a show
blushing.
Called Unnecessary Farce, where I played Billy, the very naive first day on the job cop.
Oh, okay.
And it was such a fun, chaotic show. I did all my own stunts, which was... I had to wear knee pads the entire time because I was flopping around on the ground and everything, getting hogtied. But that one,
was that the one?
That was the one where we split the stage in half for the two hotel rooms.
Okay.
And there was a Scottish mobster.
And the guy, I should know his name because he's been in so much, but of course I'm old and don't remember things very well anymore, that he had a broken leg and he had to scoot around on a scooter.
Mike Kelly.
Mike Kelly, yes. Who incidentally played Elwood in Harvey at Playcrafters, the previous version of the show. He's a wonderful He's a wonderful actor.
He was an absolute trooper in that show.
Oh, absolutely.
He made it work, and he stole the show in several scenes because of his scooter work. But that was a very, very fun show to do.
And that was a creative set as well.
I read the script and went, how is he going to have that many doors on stage? This door closes, this door opens. It was insane, but it worked. I think we had 8 doors on that set for a set that normally fits about 4. So,
well, I also felt that 84 Charing Cross Road, that set was very good as well. I loved that show.
That was a very good show. That was a show where I helped my mom learn her lines many times.
She had a boatload.
She had a boatload, and she said that that was one of the most difficult shows to memorize, simply because it wasn't a dialogue.
Exactly. It was all expositional.
It was all
expositional.
She was reading letters.
I think that's the word.
From Frank and to Frank, and because it wasn't dialogue, it was almost like little mini monologues, and knowing which one was next and everything, especially when you have no time to go backstage and check your script real quick.
Oh, I never did that.
Oh, you'll know, never. But those are the difficult shows, but when you nail it, it's so satisfying.
Oh, absolutely.
So she nailed it. She made me cry.
So bucket list role.
Bucket list role, I'd say one of the most, I have two. One that is a very well-known part, I want to be Nurse Ratched in Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh.
Now, I directed Cuckoo's Nest back in 2019. And the woman who played Nurse Ratched was great because she was, I think she was over 6 foot tall.
Oh, my gosh.
And she played the part very well, very aggressive and sassy. But I think that I want to do that role simply because it would be a challenge. Because I'm 5'1". I am not intimidating to anyone. I'm like a chihuahua. I'm just kind of there and annoying. So I think to play Nurse Ratched and to be able to pull it off would be a huge accomplishment to me. The other one is, and I do not remember the character's name because it's been a while since I've read the script, is a show called Stone Cold Murder. And that was a show that was slated for Richmond Hill to do, but it was during 2020.
Oh.
When the whole
season
got canceled.
Everybody lost the year of theater.
Yeah. And unfortunately, the man who was going to direct it, John Van de Woestijn,
passed away.
So
that was a big loss.
That was a huge loss to all the theaters.
It was a big man, but big talent.
And huge heart. We still call him, you know, the heart of Richmond Hill, you know, because he was. And to lose him, and then I was so looking forward to doing that part because I wanted to be directed by him in that role. Because that role has every gambit of emotions and full English accent the whole time as well. So that, I feel like that role, and it's a mid-30s woman, and like I said, goes through the whole gambit. It's very much almost a murder mystery thriller kind of show. I mean, it's called Stone Cold Murder.
So are you,
comedy,
you want to play the murderer?
Well, I don't want to give anything away. But it's a 4-person show. There's 3 men and then the 1 woman.
Oh.
And there is murder. There are multiple murders in that show. But like I said, the role for that, I want to show people that I can do more than just comedy. Because I've done some comedy, I've done some drama. And it was an interesting conversation. This past year, I was in Laura. And that is a drama, murder mystery, noir kind of 1940s vibe to it. And it was the first lead role I've ever had.
And no.
It was?
No. I've seen you in so much.
I was never the lead.
Huh.
I may have had, I've had many memorable performances that I had a lot of fun doing, but they were smaller parts. And I'm okay with that. I like the smaller parts as well. But it was the first lead role I had, and this was secondhand, so I'm not quoting. But the director, when he was deciding who to cast, he decided that he wanted to go with me because I was, you know, perfect age range for the role, and I fit well with the other characters and everything. And he asked my dad, do you think she has the talent to do this role? And apparently everybody in the room just looked at him like he was insane. Like, yeah.
I know who the director was, and I agree.
Yeah. And they looked at him like, yeah, of course she does. Like, she'll be good. And after I heard that, and the fact that it was my lead role, I was very nervous about it. I did everything I could to, and I didn't want to because I'm not the director, but as a lead, I feel like you have a little bit of that director response. You're kind of leading by example. If the lead member of the cast is floundering, it's going to make everybody else nervous. So I wanted to be solid. I was the first one off book. I was so dead set on getting my blocking perfectly straight and being as reliable as I possibly could. And I feel like I did a great job. But I don't know. There was a lady who recognized me in the bathroom of Richmond Hill because I came to see.
Oh, I got recognized in the ladies' room at Playcrafters, too.
I went to go 84 Charing Cross, and I was in the bathroom, and a lady was there and said, you look really familiar. Where do I know you from? And I said, probably here. Well, not the bathroom, but, like, the theater.
And that was a bit.
And she said, oh, what have you been in recently? And I said, I was just in Laura. She's like, oh, I saw that show. It was so good. Who did you play? And I was stunned for a second. I'm like, I was Laura. And she's like, oh, I didn't recognize you.
Oh, wow.
Because I wasn't wearing a dress, I guess. I don't know. But it was. So it made me wonder, did I do a good job? But I feel like every actor goes through that of you're,
well, that
you
could
think
be a compliment.
You're doing a good
that
job.
That could be a compliment in a way when you think about it because you're portraying.
They remember the character. Not
exactly.
Me. Yeah.
And you've done such a good job at drawing that character for mm-hmm. them that that's what they're remembering.
That's what I aim for. I want them to remember the character. I don't want to remember, oh, Dana did a good job playing that role. I want them to remember, oh, Billy was so funny in that play. So that's a compliment. So I'll take it that way.
Oh, that's just so funny. Because I was in the restroom at Playcrafters and a lady came in and said, were you just in a play here? That kind of surprised me because I had to have a partial wig because my hair is so short. Mm. But
well, and it's an out of context thing as well. Because
that's true.
That reminds me of a funny story. So, as we mentioned earlier, my mom was in Misery, mm-hmm. and her co-part was Jonathan Graft, and they were working box office together one night for another show. And a lady came up and started talking to my mom saying, oh, I saw Misery. You were amazing. You were so great. And Jonathan's just sitting next to her going, uh-huh, great. And then apparently the lady was like, oh, you know, look forward to seeing you again. And then a couple seconds later came back and looked at Jonathan and went, oh, and you were good too. So it is a completely out of context thing when you're so. And that's a great thing about pulling off a great show is it's sort of its own little bubble. And to see somebody outside of that bubble, it is hard to correlate sometimes.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, that happens just in everyday life.
Oh, yeah.
You see somebody in their work environment, for example, and then you mm-hmm. see them just out at shopping or something, and it's like, you look familiar, but I don't know where I know you from.
Oh, yeah. I have that all the time. And a lot of times it's because I'm like, I know, I know that person. Where do I know them from? It's because I've seen them in the audience 20 times because they come to see all the shows.
So, do you prefer one over the other, acting over directing, or vice versa?
I don't know. It's very much an apples and oranges kind of thing. Because the great thing about acting is you get to dive into your character and figure out all the motivations behind your character and how your character fits in with the story, and you're playing your part, your piece of the puzzle. And that it feels good to fit into that piece and to be part of a bigger whole. And it is a little bit less stressful because, yes, you are on stage and you have to memorize the lines and you're the one out there. So if something goes wrong, they're looking at you. So it is stressful in that way. But you only get so much satisfaction out of that. You get satisfaction out of, I played my part well, the show went great, yay. But when you're a director, there's a lot more stress because you're managing all the pieces of the puzzle. But completing the whole puzzle, there's a lot more satisfaction to it.
There's an old expression in the theater about this very thing. When the play is great, the actors get the credit. When something goes wrong, the director gets the credit.
Yes, so, absolutely.
And you mentioned this, and since Jake is also a director, describe what you're feeling when they're on stage and you're just, and it's obviously out of your control. What kind of anxiety or whatever are you going through?
Well, it depends on what's happening on stage. There's excitement. Like, for example, let's use My Son is Crazy as an example. I was sitting up in the booth running the lights and sound for it, so I got to watch it every single night from bird's eye view, which is a very unique perspective. And every single night, whenever a new character was about to come on, I'm sitting there, like, bouncing in my seat, all excited for how the audience is going to react.
That was a pretty huge cast.
Oh, 14.
Yeah.
And so there's the excitement of that. There's the pride, like, just overwhelming pride when a scene is going well and the funniest part of that scene just lands and the audience is going nuts, and it just makes you smile the whole time. On the opposite side, when somebody goes out there and they're about to say a line and they don't say anything, it's terrifying because you know that there's nothing you can do to help them. All you can do is sit there and go, come on, you got this, come on, you got this, come on, you got this. And then when they finally get it, you're like, whew. So it's a different kind of anxiety. It's like watching a horror movie and you know the killer's right behind the door. But then they get away, so it's fine. You know, that kind of
thing.
Oh,
cool.
So
that's a neat analogy.
So it's more excitement and pride when a scene goes well and you're just like, yes, they nailed it. You know, it's like going back to the being a parent thing. It's like watching your kid walk across the graduation stage, knowing I gave them the tools, but they are the ones who did it.
There's no question. By the time you finish rehearsing the show and the show opens, you are literally handing the production over to the cast. Mm-hmm. And you hope that all of your direction and everything you've imparted to them along the way sticks.
Yes.
And that they retain it. And for a lot of directors, it's, you know, describe it a million ways, but it all comes back to exactly what you're saying, Dana. It's like watching these people you've been coaching and working with for however long the rehearsal period is, mm-hmm. walking a tightrope. You know, as the director, all the things that can go wrong,
yes.
if they fall off this side or that side, and what will happen if they stay on the path that you've given them, mm-hmm. Or that you've developed with them. So it can be very rewarding, but also nerve-wracking. So, it, you know, it's...
Something I wanted to ask also. At Playcrafters, directors take a script and say, you know, present it. Can we possibly do this that season? How does Richmond Hill go about choosing their scripts?
So they kind of put out a shotgun blast to anyone interested in directing that has been stage manager before. Because we like our directors to have some backstage experience at Richmond Hill.
Ah.
So that they know what goes into doing a show. Because if you don't know how to turn the lights on, it's kind of hard to be the director. So they put out an open call for submissions. And so directors read through whatever scripts, or if they remember doing a show that they've done before or something, they can submit up to 3 scripts.
Oh.
And they say, these are the 3 that I like. I want to direct one of these 3. And then we have a play reading committee that takes all of these submissions, all 20, 30 scripts, however many we get. They read them all, and then they narrow it down to the 6 that they think would make for a good season. They submit it to the board for approval. Once they approve it, directors get a call saying, hey, we want to do your show in June or October or whatever. And then the season is set. But you got to wait for buying rights.
Interesting. So. That's pretty much what Playcrafters does. Only I don't think that you bring in 3 scripts. Is that right?
Most of the theaters in the Quad Cities have a play reading committee. And they do generally ask for submissions. It's generally not Playcrafters in a specific number, but it's not always directors who are suggesting plays. It might be someone who is a patron who is suggesting a play. It could be anyone. And then the play reading committee themselves are often suggesting plays. And it's quite a process at Playcrafters. It takes a while. But it's the same with, for example, Music Guild. They put out a notice and people suggest plays and then there's a committee that decides, the board ultimately decides, mm-hmm. and it's exactly as Dana is describing. It ends up with, okay, we want to do this show with you and this is the time slot and then we wait for to see if the rights are available right. and affordable and all of that.
Because that was a fight we had with Misery. I had been trying to direct Misery for about 10 years.
Really?
But there was some hang up with the rights for that long. They had to rewrite part of it. It was on Broadway for a while, so no one else can do it mm-hmm. while it's in Broadway.
Oh, really?
You know, so that kind of kept it caught up for a long while. But we have found that having directors submit shows of these are the 3, I want to do one of these 3, rather than general submissions and then you find a director for this play, we find that it works nicely at Richmond Hill because, one, you have to submit a show that can be done in the round. There's so many shows that I've read that just can't be done because we don't have a backdrop, because we don't have a fly system. We can't do a trapdoor because you would go into the lobby.
You can have an air mattress there.
Right, just puff it up. And having directors submit shows that they are passionate about, that they already have kind of an idea of how they're going to do it, how they're going to do this set, you know, what range of ages are they looking for these characters. It's nicer because when we did for our 50th anniversary, we did kind of the inverse. We had patrons vote the year before on here are our most popular shows that we've ever done. Vote on which ones you want to bring back. And so they selected our season, and then they found directors for those shows. Directing a show that you did not submit, because I was one of the directors that was picked.
Which show?
I did California Suite.
Okay.
And directing a show that you've never read before until you say, yeah, I can do that, is terrifying. Because you don't have all those, the those brainstormed ideas of how you're going to do the set and all that stuff. And I found personally that you do have a little bit less passion for a show that was handed to you versus one that you selected. So it's different, but I feel like it's better that, like, ooh, I love this script. I can't wait to do this script versus, yeah, I'm available. Mm-hmm. Kind of, it's different.
Oh, I agree with you. I think it is. And also, you know, it's like any other field, not in, any other field in the arts or outside of the arts. Not everybody is necessarily equally skilled in every single style of theater. You mm-hmm. mentioned California Suite, so Neil Simon is a very different animal than, say, you know, Jack Sharkey, or, you know, a classical piece, or, you know, a musical piece.
Having a director submit three proposals.
Up to three.
Up to three. Okay. So what kind of time span do you have from the time you put out the call for submissions to you start the season? Because that sounds like a lot of scripts to read.
Well, so the submissions are due at the end of March, I believe. And then we usually have the submissions submitted to the, or the season submitted to the board sometime in early June.
And your first show goes on
April.
Not that long after that. Oh, April.
So right now they are asking for submissions for the 2026 season. We're always a year ahead.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. So next year's season at Richmond Hill has already been selected, and they selected that in June of last year.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's always selected way ahead of time. So I just got done directing a show. I'm directing a show next year, and I'm already thinking about submissions for 2026.
Wow.
It's a lot to do, even in the off season.
Well, Dana, I want to thank you for coming in. I have one question that I ask every guest.
Yes.
And we've gotten a wide range of replies. So it's Saturday night.
Yes.
I don't have anything else to do. Mm-hmm. Why should I go to a community theater performance?
Short answer, it is an experience you cannot get anywhere else. There's no other form of art or media that is going to give you that same feeling of seeing actors live on stage. If something goes wrong, it goes wrong. When it goes right, you can feel the energy of the other audience members, even if it's a drama and nobody's laughing. It's the immersion. It's the atmosphere. Like I said, it's a unique experience that hopefully will never go away.
Well, again, I want to thank our guest, Dana Skiles from Richmond Hill Players in Geneseo, Illinois. And I want to thank Jake for sitting in as co-host today. And I guess that wraps it up for today. So I'm Chris Hicks.
I'm Jake Ladd.
Break a leg.
Thanks for listening to Footlights, a community theater podcast from the Quad Cities. Footlights is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. If you'd like to explore more podcasts from WVIK or support our work, you can do that at wvik.org or by downloading the WVIK app.